Structural disparities and inequity exist, but how do they affect individuals and families who are trying to break the cycle of poverty? You can join the conversation at 866-255-2762 or send us a message at the State of Opportunity Facebook page. You can also send us a tweet at State of Op, that's with two P's. Joining us now are Aaron Currier, Director of the Economic Mobility Project at Pew Charitable Trusts, and Linwood Cousins, Director and Professor at the School of Social Work at Western Michigan University. Welcome to you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Aaron, I'd like to start with you. What does economic mobility look like in America today?
Our project at Pew is investigating economic mobility and how families move up and down the economic ladder over their lifetimes and across generations. And what our research shows is a pretty mixed view. On the one hand, we know that the vast majority of adults today have higher family incomes than their parents did at the same age, and that's true across the income distribution. But at the same time, the extent of those income gains is not always enough to move someone to a different rank on the income ladder as a whole. And we see this stickiness at the ends, which means people who were raised in the bottom are highly likely to remain in the bottom themselves as adults, and people who were raised at the top are pretty likely to stay at the top.
Aaron, is this a new picture, or has the country looked this way for some time?
Well, we don't actually know. The research that we have conducted is based on longitudinal data that's actually developed and housed at the University of Michigan. It's called the Panel Study of Income Dynamics, and it follows real families over time. It was started in 1968 with a subset of American families, and now we are looking at the outcomes for those families' children. So because of the limitations of the data, we don't really know about, for example, the grandparents' generation, and the children of today's adults are still too young.
Linwood, has Michigan become a place where economic mobility is more limited?
Reportedly, that's the case if you follow what has been occurring with the auto industry and the industries that are offshoots of that. Those things are sort of played out in the newspapers every day, I believe, that they have had an effect on mobility. But, you know, we are reportedly in a period of recovery, except that that happens much slower or at a slower pace for those at the bottom of the economic ladder, those who perhaps are most in need of moving up.
Aaron, we can talk about economic mobility, but make the distinction for us between income and wealth.
Sure, that's a great question. When we define income, we mean it as the total income derived from anything that's taxable income. So earnings, the interest, dividends, and any cash transfers like Social Security. Wealth, on the other hand, is an estimate of all things that a person or a family has to draw on. So their home equity, their farm or their business, their checking and their savings accounts, minus any debts.
So in the picture that you're painting, that wealth gap in the U.S. has grown significantly.
Sure. We see that the income gap and the wealth gap have grown significantly, though it is very interesting to distinguish between income and wealth in one particular sense. When we look at the way that the income distribution has changed over the last generation, we can see a widening out for each of the rungs of the ladder, so to speak. So the thresholds that define what is the bottom fifth and the second fifth, those have actually gotten larger over time when you look at income. When you look at wealth, the same is not true. The wealth distribution has actually compressed for the middle and the bottom over the last generation, while it has widened out at the top.
Hmm. Linwood, when we talk about economic mobility, how does that impact communities where there are high concentrations of poverty?
First and foremost, it limits their ability to move or to be mobile in accessing opportunities that may change their circumstance. And that means both their ability to increase their income, their ability to improve the educational opportunities for their children in terms of the quality of schools. And beyond that, the overall quality of life, accessing health care, the taken for granted kinds of things that families and children do in neighborhoods and communities in terms of their social and recreational lives. All of those things are quite challenged in communities of concentrated poverty. So the ability to be mobile and to have opportunities to move beyond that have been followed quite closely by social scientists. And although there isn't total agreement on the extent to which personal effects versus what we would call neighborhood effects or community effects are the most powerful, it's clear that in many circumstances when a low-income family or a family that's living in concentrated poverty is able to move to a community that is at higher on the economic ladder, both in terms of social characteristics and in terms of economic characteristics, the quality of their lives improves.
We're speaking with Linwood Cousins, professor at Western Michigan University, and Aaron Currier of Pew Charitable Trusts. And we'd like to hear from you. Have you experienced a sudden change in wealth or income? Did that change the way you saw the world or the way you felt the world saw you? Call us at 866-255-2762 or send us a tweet at State of Op. Aaron, we've been talking about inequity and privilege. Is there a connection between that economic mobility and inequity?
Well, so that's a great question, and it draws a distinction here between how we define those things. So income inequality really looks at the difference between the richest Americans and the poorest Americans, how wide that spread is, whereas economic mobility looks not at the distance between the richest and the poorest Americans, but at their ability to actually navigate up and down that income ladder over their lifetimes. It's this question of, you know, if the richest Americans are 1,000 times richer than the poorest Americans or 1,000,000 times richer than the poorest Americans, that may not matter if they're actually able to change positions on the income ladder and anyone has equal opportunity to meet that top slot. So we look at their opportunities to actually make it into the top or make it into the middle or to fall down, because in order for someone to move up, someone else has to fall down. And what we see is that regardless of how wide the income distribution is, those who start at the bottom do not right now have an equal chance of rising.
So what does that mean? We have 1 in 4 kids living in Michigan in poverty. Linwood, when you hear that, what are the chances for those kids?
Given the data, not very positive. I mean, what we are talking about then is the transmission of intergenerational poverty, that these children will likely not do much better than their parents. And that challenges me, the notion of democracy and the notion of a system, of a culture, of a nation that embraces not only opportunity for individuals, but for disadvantaged groups. And given the wealth that we have, it questions whether or not we're willing to share it. You know, we get dogged in these debates about whether or not people who are poor, and consequently if their families, their children, whether or not they've caused their circumstances because of poor decisions or because of issues of we might consider morality and character. But at the end of the day, we're all people. We're all vulnerable to decisions that will negatively affect us. But to conclude that because of a person's station in life based on the accident of birth, that you know, that is to say that they're born into a poor family in a concentrated, impoverished neighborhood, that somehow that means they shouldn't get a helping hand, that's troubling. And so, you know, I'm playing around with two things here. On the one hand, that yes, these children they face challenging odds in moving out of their circumstance, but I think we have quite a bit of opportunities to help change that. And so the conclusion doesn't have to be a fixed one.
Let's invite Leah in Ann Arbor into the conversation. Leah, thanks for joining us. What's your question or comment?
Thank you. Thank you. My comment is, if I'm someone who grew up in poverty, the child of a mother who did not finish high school, and she grew up in abject poverty, the oldest of 10, I went on to not only finish high school and undergrad, but get a master's and then a PhD at U of M. And it's just really, it's really interesting what you're saying about intergenerational poverty and how pervasive it is, because I looked at the rest of my family, and they're really sort of living paycheck to paycheck. My mom still lives in a trailer, struggles financially, and it's not through any character flaw. It's that there are such differences in forms of capital, whether they're social, cultural, economic, and it's just so incredibly pervasive. And, when I look at the research around, because my field is education, and I think, how did I make it out of that cycle? It's just amazing to me. And it's just so pervasive. And I think that we're becoming more comfortable, I see, in education talking about privilege based on ethnicity and culture, but less so related to class. It's like somehow that's the thing we don't want to talk about in America.
Leah, what do you think made the difference for you?
You know, I think that the big difference for me was my mother rented a home. We moved to a neighborhood that was not a high-poverty neighborhood. So we were in kind of a grungy area. We rented a home, but my friends in junior high and high school had parents who were college educated. And there was a great deal of academic press, I felt, just for my friends. And I think that I started to see myself as someone who could go to college, that could be a possibility for me. And, you know, I think about, you know, I do a lot of work with schools in Detroit now. And I think about what's it like for kids who grew up, like I grew up in poverty, but don't have friends that let them sort of see a different possibility. And also I got a good education. I went to a good school district, even though I was very poor. So I think those things made a difference.
Leah, thanks so much for the call.
Thank you.
So Linwood, does this speak a bit to that issue of what we see in neighborhoods where there's concentrated poverty? It sounds like Leah had the opportunity to see other options for her life.
Yes, she sort of hit the nail on the head, so to speak, that whether she was conscious of it or not, what we tend to know is that neighborhoods have opportunities, they have levels of and types of socialization toward college attendance and other behaviors that that are both consciously and unconsciously internalized by residents and by children. And we can't take that for granted. I mean, these things aren't always visible, but you could line up numerous people and you would hear similar stories as the caller in terms of the effects of their community, whether they are aware of them or not, or I could recite for them in looking at issues of mobility and the difference between what happens in terms of socialization in a concentrated poverty community versus a middle to higher income community. The differences would be stark, and they've been well documented.
Aaron, Leah also hit upon this issue of the stickiness of poverty, and you alluded to it earlier. How difficult is it in the face of inequity, of income inequality, for an individual to not just escape poverty, but not to slide back into it?
Well, the data show that among people who are raised in the bottom fifth of the income distribution, that bottom 20%, 70% of them remain below the middle as adults themselves, and only 4% make it all the way to the top fifth. And similarly, we do see some sliding back, especially from the middle class. You know, the actual middle of the income distribution, we see about a third of people slide out of the middle. But I think what's really stark about the data that we've uncovered is the relationship between mobility and race. We know that African American families in particular are much more likely to be downwardly mobile than white families. And in fact, African American adults who are raised in solidly middle income homes, about more than half of them fall out of the middle as adults, compared to only about a third of whites. This actually speaks a lot to the other topic of conversation, which is neighborhood poverty. research that our project has released shows that children growing up in high poverty neighborhoods explains between a quarter and a third of that black-white mobility gap and downward mobility. So just speaking to the environment, the fact that environment really does matter and that there are pervasive differences in terms of demographics in the United States and how people experience mobility, and neighborhoods are capturing a lot of that as well.
Lynn, what if the research shows that economic mobility is so challenging and limited? Why do you think the American story of pulling yourself up by your bootstraps continues to be such an enduring idea?
I think it appeals. I don't know. I'll just say I look at that question a lot, and I've been working on that issue recently. It must appeal to a sense of or a piece about Western cultural heritage, which is around individualism and around merit, and you know the fact that we are a nation of immigrants, meaning that in one sense, many of the people who came here to pursue opportunities, often pulling themselves up, so to speak, by their bootstraps, that we've married ourselves to that narrative, and we won't let it go despite the fact that it just doesn't hold up over time, that, you can look at a number of texts on white privilege, on white affirmative action as against or as in contrast to affirmative action for African Americans and other groups. And you find that all Americans have benefited from community, from relationships, from the government, and that corporations equally have benefited as well from what in fact is the way we transact business in this nation, as opposed to what we believe, and that is that we pulled ourselves up by our bootstraps. So, to get back to the point, I think there's something about us culturally that has left us married to this notion of individualism and merit, and we need to get beyond that.
If I could just jump in, I completely agree, and I also think a piece of what may be happening is...
In just about 20 seconds, Erin.
Okay, rates of absolute mobility, that families do have higher incomes than their parents. So even if they're stuck at the bottom, they can point to income growth that they've experienced, and that makes them feel like they're closer to achieving the American dream.
Erin Currier is the director of the Economic Mobility Project at Pew Charitable Trusts, and Linwood Cousins is director and professor at the School of Social Work at Western Michigan University. Thanks so much to both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.